Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to the 21st episode of The Leading Tone podcast. Today we discuss composers 51 through 60 of our top 100 composers list. But before we get into that, let's guess that lick.
Guess that lick or don't miss the prize.
Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-hosts will have three listens to guess that lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here is the scoring breakdown. 1 point each for the piece, movement, composer, time period, and the genre. Not gonna have the movement, I don't think.
Okay, so I get a bonus point.
Yeah, bonus point here already, but we'll get right into it.
Okay, I'm between two completely different nationalities here. Okay, well, it's definitely a piano work. It definitely sounds Russian.
All right, get another listen. That was the second listen. What are you thinking?
Is this Scriabin?
It is Scriabin.
Oh, okay. It's not the piano concerto in F sharp minor, because that's not the beginning of that.
Correct. It's not the piano concerto.
Is this part of one of his collections of piano works?
It is part of a collection, yeah. It has a very generic name to the collection.
This is tough. This is really tough. Is it just an etude?
It is an etude. That's it.
Really? All right. Yeah. That was, oh my gosh, that was my last guess. I was holding on to that one. So maybe I can listen for key. But Scriabin is a late romantic turn of the century piano etude. Now let's see if I can figure out maybe the key. All right, I'll get my third listen here. Is it E-flat minor?
Okay, we've got somebody with a good ear here. I will give the point to you. It's actually D-sharp minor.
Wow.
But you would never guess that. So, yeah, we'll give that to you. So, it is Scriabin's 12th etude in his 12 etudes, opus 8, etude in D-sharp minor, subtitled Etude Pathétique. And it is from the late Romantic period, early kind of turn of the century period. And it is a piano etude. So you got all the points there.
Wow. Okay. That is one of the toughest ones that I've gotten here. Hey, my RO skills professors are probably really proud.
Yeah, I would say so. If you could get the key out of that, I think so.
Now, that's a fun one. Thanks. Thanks for that one. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. We've heard it before. Performed live. A really fun one, a really difficult one. We've got 5 points for Alex now for the month. We've restarted on the month for December. So 5 points for Alex, 0 points for me currently, because I haven't guessed. And Alex will be going up to 33 points all time, and I will be at 35.
I'm going to make up those 2 points one day. We hope that you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to today's topic. Welcome to today's topic. This is our 6th edition, hard to believe, of our top 100 composer series. This means it's also month 6 of the podcast. That's really fun there, and it's been a great time, and we've had a lot of fun going through these composers. Couple things to keep in mind. This is our personal preferences, and composers all the way down here, 51 to 60, are still composers that we love. In fact, all 100 of these composers are composers that we enjoy in some way, shape, or form. We love all these composers. It's just a matter of personal preference, and we thought it'd be a good way to give you a tour of some of our preferences for our listening. Fernando, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's just, like you said, a personal preference, and in no way is it about the quality or the, you know, superiority of some composers over others. It's just about who we like to listen to, and it's constantly changing. Our list is always changing, and this was just a moment in time for our listening. We are already revising this list and plan on having a future episode where we show you how we revised it or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know mine has already, there's about 25 composers I want to add to the list, and I'm like, oh my gosh, who am I even going to take out here? And it's also great because we get to expose each other to composers that we might not necessarily think of putting on this list. I know that Fernando has introduced me to many composers that I've definitely wanted to add to my list, so expect some shakeups. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into composer number 51 here. This is John Barnes Chance, ranked number 53 on my list and 74 on Fernando's. He's an American composer primarily known for his contributions to the realm of wind band from 1932 to 1972. He is just such a great composer of wind band works, and something that strikes me about John Barnes Chance is the great melodic percussion writing and some really, really catchy melodies in some of these works like Incantation and Dance and Blue Lake Overture, Variations on a Korean Folk Song. What do you think, Fernando?
Yeah, he's just an essential wind band composer. He's got a lot of diverse works for band. I really like the diversity amongst his catalog, and I think they're really accessible and still relatively modern. So you can start introducing more modern music to younger band students. It's still achievable for them, but it still has a modern twist and is challenging. So I think that's really fun. And then he also has some music for orchestra, if you are interested in that, but primarily known for his wind band works.
Right. And since this composer is so recent in history, we unfortunately don't have any recordings that we can supply you with today. Hopefully in the future we will have some. I would say start with his Variations on a Korean Folk Song or Incantation and Dance. And then if you're moving to large-scale works, for orchestra, his first symphony, and then for band, his second symphony. So there's a lot to dive into with John Barnes Chance. Let's talk a little bit about who John Barnes Chance was before we move on to our next composer here. He got his Bachelor's of Music and Master's of Music from the University of Texas. He was a pupil of Clifton Williams and Kent Kennan. Clifton Williams is known in the wind band world. I don't know a whole lot about Kent Kennan. I just know that both Fernando and I have performed his trumpet sonata, and we both really like that piece. So that's a composer that we'll maybe have to explore more down the line.
Yeah, and Clifton Williams also not on our list, but somebody that we might talk about in the future.
Absolutely. And so I mentioned John Barnes Chance and his percussion writing earlier. He actually played timpani for the Austin Symphony Orchestra, so I don't think that that's a coincidence that his percussion parts are so fun.
Right, yeah.
He was also an arranger and a composer in residence for a couple of the army bands in Texas, so he had a pretty lucrative composing and arranging career, as well as a teaching career. He taught at the University of Kentucky, and in that time, he just wrote some really stellar works for band and orchestra. I can imagine this list without him. It's just, I've really had great formative moments in my band career, both throughout my undergrad and my high school experience playing some of his music. So he continues to be one that I really enjoy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of our list ends up being a lot of the composers that we've played in some type of ensemble, whether it be a wind band or an orchestra. It's very much influenced by the music that we've experienced. It's a really important aspect of this whole list. But sometimes it's composers that we've never played or performed. But in this case, I've performed a good few works by John Barnes Chance. So it's one of those where it just gets influenced by that. And once you've played it a couple times, it kind of becomes an earworm and you want to listen to it a little bit more.
And what's funny about the contrast of today's list is that there's a lot of variety, one. And two, these next couple of composers, I'd say, are ones that we probably haven't performed much of their works because there's quite a few large-scale works or maybe some more obscure works. So what do you say we go ahead and move on to our next composer, Fernando?
All right, sounds good.
Number 52, Richard Wagner, number 65 on my list and 62 on Fernando. Some might be shocked to see him a little bit lower on our list. He's a German romantic composer who's incredibly famous for a number of reasons, but he was born in 1813, passed away in 1889, so just before the turn of the century there. Fernando, you want to talk some about Richard Wagner?
Yeah, so Wagner has really expansive works that inspired so many composers of the turn of the century and Romantic periods. And a lot of composers really identified their music with Wagner's music. They're very long works that can be slightly drawn out. You have to have a good amount of time to really listen and focus if you're going to dive into Wagner.
Right, yeah. And for me, with Richard Wagner, I'm kind of in the same boat. There's a lot of really drawn out works by Wagner. But without Wagner, you wouldn't have a lot of the great 20th century orchestral music that we enjoy, or modern orchestral music and film music in particular. People always draw comparisons between John Williams and Richard Wagner. But I will say this, I think that the musical ideals that Wagner stood for would have come into existence eventually, with or without Wagner. So I don't think that he is the be-all, end-all, like many people. In fact, some of Wagner's maybe not so great personal tendencies, which we won't really get into, also lead him to be one that kind of drops on my list a little bit. But operas like Tannhäuser and Tristan and Isolde, Parsifal, Lohengrin, Valkyrie, just really, really excellent works there, but maybe a little bit drawn out, but you can pull some great excerpts and some great leitmotif from those works.
Right. When we say drawn out, I mean, these are more than multiple hours long, almost 5 hours sometimes. If you wanted to listen to the entire Ring Cycle, it'd take you all day. That's kind of what we mean by drawn out there.
Right. I'm with you, Fernando. I know you've sat through a lot of these. I personally have not. I've taken a lot of selected excerpts, and maybe I've listened to a lot of the music from these operas, but I have not sat down and watched or listened to the whole thing. I know it's a musical rite of passage that I'll eventually force myself to do.
And it changes your perspective a little bit, because you get to hear things in context, and especially with some of the stuff that we're going to talk about after we take a listen here, it changes how you perceive certain things at certain moments. So with that being said, let's go ahead and take a listen to the excerpt that we have prepared. What do we have prepared today, Alex?
Well, we have Richard Wagner's Tannhäuser, the overture from that, about the first couple of minutes of this work. This is one that I've really, really enjoyed, and I think is just a great melody and is really exciting.
Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Richard Wagner's Tannhäuser Overture. Just the first couple of minutes here, and I think it really showcases Wagner's orchestration and the way that he could really develop into a climax where it kind of keeps you on the edge of your seat for a while, and then there's a big arrival, and it's a really good one.
Right. I don't think it was necessarily unheard of the time for people to be writing music like this, but Wagner was really notorious at the time because he was so aggressively expanding the orchestra, particularly in the brass section. You could hear that was a lot of brass playing. This, in fact, was not an arrangement for orchestra. This is the marine band playing. We couldn't quite find a great recording of the orchestra that we had available to us, but we think that this wind band transcription is quite good and still retains a lot of the excitement of the original.
So with Tannhäuser being an opera, we should mention again that Wagner was a key figure in the world of opera. He's really well known for that. And one of the key features in those operas is something called leitmotif. That is when there's a kind of recurring theme that will signify a certain action or a certain character. It represents that character or a certain idea. And Wagner was very well known for that. He was using it throughout all of his operas, and it kind of ties together all of the Ring cycle, and it's a whole series, basically. It's like reading a series of books like The Lord of the Rings or something.
Right.
It definitely has that fantastic quality. It has that mythological quality to it that is really, really interesting to some people, and it really ties the whole thing together. Very much like The Lord of the Rings, it is very long. It would take you the whole day to get through the Ring cycle. So it's all tied together with that idea of leitmotif, and that's a compositional strategy or approach that he uses pretty frequently.
Well, yeah, and that's Richard Wagner. One other important point that I wanted to go over here is that Wagner also kind of cemented the ruining of the voice in opera. A lot of opera singers, I think, hold this opinion, where this orchestra is so massive that having to project over that is an incredible physical toll on the voice. And I think that's worth mentioning because it certainly puts a lot of demands on the singer as well as the orchestra.
Yeah, definitely worth mentioning. You have to think about these enormous orchestras with unusual instruments. Wagner was using the alto horn, and he had the Wagner tuba. That's a pretty well-known instrument that has to be included in a lot of his works and named after him. So there was a very large orchestra with a lot of brass, and to sing over that takes a lot of lung.
Yes, a lot of lung is right, Fernando. So I think that that's good for Richard Wagner. I think we can move on to composer number 53 here. Fernando, you want to introduce this one?
Yes. So number 53, we've got Paul Dukas. He was 53 on the overall list. He was 66th on Alex's and 61 on mine. He's a French turn of the century composer, 1865 to 1935. And I just find his music to be really, really interesting because it has this very romantic style, but the orchestration is different. It's something that was unusual for the time, and I think it has a unique twist and a French twist in a lot of ways. He really abandoned and destroyed a lot of his works, so he's got a limited output. But what we do have is really, really interesting, and it goes beyond what people know him for, which is The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Right, and Dukas is known for being really meticulous. That's why he destroyed a lot of his works. Just stuff that he wasn't happy with, right? Dukas, for me, I mean, he's just another great French composer of great melodies and orchestral music. His Symphony in C and Sorcerer's Apprentice, to me, are two big standouts here, but he falls in line with Bizet and Franck and a lot of these French composers for me. It's just unfortunate that he stacked up against a lot of those composers in a lot of ways, and that's why he's maybe a little bit lower for me, because if I had to pick from those French composers, I'd probably say Bizet I would rank above Dukas. Well, we have some great listening today. This is often touted as one of Dukas' best works. This is his Sorcerer's Apprentice, and very well known, of course, for appearing in Disney's Fantasia, a very, very famous segment of that film. And then even there was a Disney film, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, years later in the 2000s, and I don't know how much of the orchestral music is used in that one, but I was thinking about that earlier. This is Dukas, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, a little bit into that work. Let's take a listen.
That was Dukas, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and that was towards the end of this work. What a really climactic arrival here. It's one of my favorite points of this work, and I really, really love the use of the brass, and obviously the bassoon melody is kind of the iconic one, but this is kind of the secondary theme here. Not everybody is really well accustomed to this one, and I think it's equally as melodic and tuneful.
Right. Oh, I totally agree. And I think at this point, Mickey in The Sorcerer's Apprentice is probably not having a very good time. I think the buckets are going crazy at this point, and there's the brooms and all of that. But man, talk about demand in all of these parts. This may seem like simple music, but it's really, really quite demanding, especially in the brass, but there's some really crazy string parts in here as well. How about all of that triple tonguing and all the high stuff and the trumpets and horns? Oh my gosh, so demanding, but so much fun and so driving and so aggressive. I feel like it's rare that we get to listen to really, truly modern and aggressive sounding orchestral music on this show. So this one's really exciting for me.
Yeah, that is a really good point. And to add to that a little bit, at this point in the music, it's trying to tell a story like the rest of the work, and that just shows that it was really in that romantic style of being programmatic. And being programmatic, having that romantic style, really lends itself well to film music. And so if you listen closely, you'll be able to hear some quotes that John Williams would later go on to use in Star Wars.
Oh yeah, and some of that harmony too. That harmony is so characteristic of a lot of film music today.
Right, and so it just shows the influence that Dukas had on a lot of different composers over time, and I think he has really influenced film music the most. So if you're interested in film music already, then maybe this could be your route into more romantic styles or something like that.
Right, and with that, I think we categorize Dukas in this way as being a romantic composer, but also in that turn of the century category because of the harmony that he's using here is a little bit more modern, but still very much aligned with the romantic ideals, especially in this piece. He also had a long career as a music critic from 1892 to 1932, which is quite interesting. So he heard a lot of music and probably gave him some ideas for his own works. He began composing at age 14, he enrolled in the Paris Conservatory, like many of the composers that we've talked about on this show, at age 16. I feel like that we're always talking about the Paris Conservatory and this next point, the Prix de Rome. He actually made several attempts at the Prix de Rome, which is the top composition prize for the Paris Conservatory here. And he placed as high as second, but he ultimately fell short of the prize, like many of the most famous French composers, surprisingly, maybe not as appreciated in their time as they are now. History, philosophy, and politics were all a really big influence on his music. So maybe similar to a composer like Verdi or other romantic composers in that way. So he has a little bit more of this 20th century harmony going on, but still very much in the romantic ideal here. Great composer, Dukas. There's a lot to listen to, and we recommend jumping into this work or his Symphony in C.
And also La Paris.
Yeah, La Paris. Yeah, I forgot to even mention that. That's a fantastic work. All right, well, let's talk about composer number 54, Alexander Borodin. Ranked number 40 on my list and 90 on Fernando's. A little bit of a discrepancy here. Probably, I think I weighed a couple of his pieces higher maybe than his output, because his output is actually kind of limited in this case. He's a Russian romantic composer from 1833 to 1887 here. We'll mention this a few times, but he's primarily a chemist and a doctor by trade. That being said, his symphonies are really quite underrated, I think, as well as his work in Prince Igor, some of my favorite melodies for the orchestra and so characteristic of Russian music, like Tchaikovsky or Glinka. Really, really great composer here. Fernando, what do you think about Borodin?
Yeah, I think Borodin was very much a formative composer for Russian composers over time. Obviously, after him, they were looking back on the group of composers that were popular at the time. But like we said before, limited output, he just kind of fell on my list a little bit. He was composing as a hobby, so it makes sense that his output wasn't as prolific as some others that were composing at the time. A lot of his works are very lyrical, but some of them have very unusual harmonies that I find really nice, but some people, it might be off-putting for them.
Right, yeah, I can definitely see that, because he definitely has his own harmonic language that's unique to him and a little bit different than the rest of the Russian composers at the time.
Yeah, I think he was more free to experiment with a lot of his harmonies and a lot of his compositions, because I don't think that he was as focused on sticking to the rules and what are people going to say if I, you know, use something crazy in my music, because he wasn't primarily a composer.
So we're going to listen to probably my favorite work by Borodin here. This is from his Prince Igor, just some of the most fantastic melodies that have been written. This excerpt here is the Polovetsian dance from that work. Let's take a listen. Thank you. All right, that was an excerpt from Alexander Borodin's Prince Igor, the Polovetsian Dances. Oh my gosh, what a gorgeous melody here with the oboe and the English horn. Just brilliant writing. Hard to believe that he is not a composer by trade with that. But you could still hear, like we said, some of those maybe a little bit more unusual harmonies.
Right. Definitely some unusual harmonies in there, but still beautiful all the same. It's a really wonderful section here, and it's very tuneful.
Right. Yeah, I think that this is the work that kind of sold it for me for Borodin. So definitely worth listening to the whole thing. After that section, it gets a little bit faster and a little bit more energetic. Lots of fun stuff in this work. But let's talk a little bit more. Let's give you some context to who Borodin was. So Borodin is actually not his birth last name. He's actually an illegitimate son of Prince Luka Gedeonov. He was born Alexander Gedeonov and registered and baptized under one of his father's servants' last name, Borodin. So that kind of stuck, and so that's what we know him as today. He's a famous member of the Russian Five, or the Mighty Handful, with Kui, Mussorgsky, Balakirev, and Rimsky-Korsakov. So that's a really famous group, and you hear them kind of grouped together a lot. And they did all have some pretty similar ideals and also compositional voices, with Rimsky-Korsakov kind of being the standout.
Yeah, and I think that group is so fascinating because all of them are very unique composers, and they were really doing different things in their lives and also in their music. I think they were all taking music in a different direction that was not the common way of doing things at the time or in Russia.
Right, yeah. And I think that there's also something to be said for it maybe being a little bit more commonplace in a way for a lot of musicians to not be able to do music for a living then, because it was such a academic thing or a high class thing in a lot of cases in a lot of places around the world. So I guess having that income coming in from being a chemist and a doctor definitely helped him out. So like we've said with Borodin, he's best known for his symphonies and Prince Igor, which we listened to today, and then another piece, In the Steppes of Central Asia, a really interesting one that you guys should check out. And yeah, I'm a big fan of Borodin, and I'm excited to get to know even more of his works, and we'll see where he ends up on the list after we inevitably redo this list on the show. All right, Fernando, do you have anything else to add?
No, I think we're good to move on.
All right, this is number 55, Anton Bruckner, number 57 on my list, 73 on Fernando's. I feel like that the 50s, really through the 100s, are kind of fluid in a lot of ways, because so many of these composers can flip-flop on any given day. Anyway, so he's an Austrian Romantic composer, Anton Bruckner. He was born in 1824, passed away in 1896, so similar lifespan here to, with a lot of these composers on today's list. Just this really interesting combination to me of Beethoven, the music of Beethoven, and the music of Wagner, actually. A lot of his symphonic work ends up feeling slightly derivative of these two composers, but I think that these influences also make his works great as well, because, I mean, if you're basing your music off the music of Beethoven, then you're probably going to have some pretty solid music there. Fernando, what do you think?
Bruckner was an excellent composer of large-scale works, similar to Beethoven and Wagner in that way. Bruckner also had a large output of sacred music, and that's kind of a big part of his catalog. It can't be overlooked, even though it's not exactly short music or secular music. The sacred music is definitely a standout for me.
Right, yeah, I'm totally with you there. That's a part of his repertoire that I'm probably less familiar with. I'm more familiar with his large-scale works, because he was one that I came onto after I really started to enjoy the works of Gustav Mahler, who we talked about last week. And if you're a big fan of Mahler's works, or Beethoven's works, or Wagner, Bruckner is one that you'll probably enjoy a good bit. So we have some great listening for you today. This is his Symphony in D minor. It's actually an unnumbered symphony. The rest of his symphonies are numbered, but it was composed in between his first and second symphonies, a little bit earlier in his career, but still a worthy listening for the show for sure. This is Bruckner's Symphony in D minor. Let's take a listen. ¶¶
was Bruckner's Symphony in D minor, number 0, but not actually composed before number 1. It's between 1 and 2. That was the third movement. And it's got an interesting story to it here. It was actually critiqued pretty heavily in its premiere, and so Bruckner wanted to kind of nullify the symphony, and he kind of scratched it out here. He scratched out the number 2 for a number 0, or actually a null symbol, which is a 0 with a slash through it. He was not happy about this one, but I think it can still equally be enjoyed as much as any other symphony by Bruckner. It's definitely got a lot of qualities that are Brucknerian in a way.
Right, and it could be that audiences just weren't ready for that kind of sound yet.
Yeah, that's true. It could be that audiences just weren't ready for that sound. It's still an equally delightful one. I really enjoy when the strings kind of carry the melody towards the middle of this excerpt and towards the end of this excerpt. It just really has a really good flow to it and a really pleasant melody.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm totally with you there. I was really happy when we found this one. Lots of heavy hitting listening on this episode. So with Bruckner, we've mentioned that he's very rooted in the traditions of Beethoven, as well as Schubert and Wagner. Those are all really big in terms of his harmony and orchestration there. And we've mentioned his symphonies and his masses are probably a good place to get started with Bruckner. Bruckner 7, Bruckner 9 are some standouts there. And then he was known to be quite humble in the presence of his contemporaries. He really had a reputation of respect and admiration, particularly with composers like Wagner. And then he knew a younger Gustav Mahler even. So he left a really, really lasting impression on Mahler's music. And that's how we got a lot of these big symphonies, not just the influence from Wagner. Bruckner was also a huge influence on Gustav Mahler as well.
And I think you can definitely tell that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's written all over his music. It's quite obvious that those three, Wagner, Mahler, and Bruckner, all are kind of linked in that way, and often are linked in that way by a lot of orchestral musicians and conductors. Well, Fernando, I think that is enough on Anton Bruckner. Let's go ahead and move on to our next Anton on the list, number 56, Anton Weber. Now, this is a composer ranked number 54 on my list and 77 on Fernando's. Austrian 20th century composer. He really is known for being quite a strict serialist composer from 1883 to 1945. Do you want to talk about serialism a little bit, Fernando?
Yeah, so serialism, it's not cereal like the breakfast food, but it is cereal as in a series. And so serialist composers of the second Viennese school would take a certain order of notes, specifically for these composers like Weber and Berg and Schoenberg. They would take the 12 notes of a scale, put them in a certain order, and then they would have to adhere to that order throughout the entire piece. And some did it a little bit more strictly than others. Webern is one that was very strict with it. He was always trying to keep the order exact and trying to serialize everything, keep everything in a series of some way, the rhythm, the pitches. So there are different things that you can put into a specific series or a specific set, and these composers were doing that. They were putting, Webern was trying to put everything into a set in a lot of cases.
Right, and to me that's what's so admirable about Anton Webern's music, is that it's so strict and so far in that serious direction that I can't help but admire it, because it just, in terms of construction, it's so meticulous. He really taught me to take the work of the second Viennese school more seriously. His work on his Langsmersatz is among one of my favorite works of the last couple of years that I've discovered, and Webern's orchestral music and his variations in particular are really underrated. But his chamber works like that Langsmersatz that I talked about here, really, really fantastic works. And out of the three, Schoenberg, Webern, and Berg, that are linked in the second Viennese school, Webern's my favorite, which is a little bit different of a take than Fernando.
Right. Mine is actually Berg, and I think we talk about him a little bit later.
Spoiler alert.
I'll save it for that. But an important thing to remember when we're talking about these serialist composers is that the music can be very aurally challenging. It's very much academic music, but it can be appreciated just like any other composition, I think. I think it's still a work of art, and it's similar to a visual artist having very strict rules on their paintings or on their artwork, very much similar in that same way. They were still trying to achieve something in a lot of cases, sometimes just trying to be academic, but academia can be beautiful as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It is such a beautiful thing. Let's talk a little bit more about the facts about Webern. We don't have any listening for you today. Too new. We don't really have the rights to Webern's works just yet, but he's actually rumored to be the first ever pupil of Arnold Schoenberg, along with Berg, a little bit before Berg, actually. So it's rumored. They haven't really traced the exact time. It's a little bit unknown there, but this group, we've talked about the Second Viennese School. It's a complete stark contrast to what's considered the first Viennese school of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert in that first school, classical early romantic composers there, as opposed to the Second Viennese school of 20th century serialism. I don't think you get more different music in that way, but they both follow a structure. You can compare them in that way, I guess. He's this huge proponent of this 12-tone compositional technique, serialism. Like we said, it's very, very strict music compared to even Schoenberg's music or Berg. Webern's music being so strict with that is certainly admirable in that sense.
Yeah, it really is admirable how Webern was able to make such really, really beautiful music with such strict rules and strict structures for himself. And I feel like I would have driven myself crazy trying to always use a certain set of notes like he was doing. You know, it's like working with a puzzle in a lot of ways, where you're trying to fit these different parts into sometimes places that they might not normally fit.
That's a great observation on Anton Webern's music. Well, I wish we could do some listening, but let's go ahead and move on to our number 57 composer on this list. This is one that Fernando is quite a fan of. This is Karel Husa, ranked number 100, last on my list, and 31 on Fernando. So I'll let Fernando take it away before I let my opinion be known.
All right, so Husa was a Czech-American composer pretty recently, 1921 to 2016, and he was another really significant composer of modern band music, along with Chance that we talked about earlier. He has more abstract works that are really, really interesting to me, but that causes his music to be slightly less accessible to a lot of people, and not one that a lot of wind bands on the high school level or middle school level are pulling out at all. Very challenging music that was written as art rather than purely educational material. So those are the kinds of the things that I enjoy about Husa's music.
Right. And like we made known at the beginning of this episode, just because Husa's ranked number 100 last on my top 100 list does not mean that he's a bad composer in any way. It was just the luck of the draw, I guess, with Husa. There are just a couple more composers that I enjoy a little bit more, but he could probably move up or down depending on the day. On paper, he's one that I'm really, really interested in because of his just the challenge of his music and the unique harmonic language. Some works that I really enjoy by him, his music for Prague, and this is one I just recently discovered, actually, his concerto for orchestra. Bartok's not the only one. Really, really fantastic work there. So that's one that I'll continue to get to know, and maybe Husa will move up a couple pegs.
Yeah, possibly. So no listening for Husa either, because he was a very recent composer. But we do have some facts about him. An American composer and conductor of Czech descent, born in Prague, so Czech-American, like we said before. He studied at the Prague Conservatory from 1946 to 1951, and then moved to Paris, where he attended the École Normale de Musique, and he studied there with Honegger, so another composer we've talked about before. And then he studied at the Paris Conservatory, another one at the Paris Conservatory here, with Nadia Boulanger.
Right, yeah, I feel like that we're discussing the Paris Conservatory every single episode now, and Nadia Boulanger as well. She really had so much influence over so many of these composers. So in 1954, Husa comes to the U.S. and he becomes an American citizen. He really was just such an exploratory composer. He explored so many different 20th century ideas, including neoclassicism and serialism, like Webern. but his music is more of a mix of these different styles as opposed to being one strict style. A couple works that I would recommend for Husa if you want to get started: Music for Prague, Apotheosis of This Earth. He has a lot of concertos and string quartets. He basically composed in every genre of classical music but the opera.
Right. Well, it shows you that he did have a pretty high output, and he was really trying a lot of different things, and he was a very serious composer, and that's why I enjoy him so much. He has such diverse works within a lot of different classical music genres.
Right. Yeah, I'm totally there with you. So Fernando's going to help me get a little bit more into Husa's music, but what do you say we move on to the next composer on this list?
Let's do that. So number 58 on our list, on our combined list, is Edward Lalo. Alex had him at 79, and I had him at 54. He was a French romantic composer from 1823 to 1892. For me, he has a really dramatic compositional style with engaging chromatic harmony, strong melodies, and great orchestration. He's one that I did a project on while here at university, and it is really fascinating music to me because he gets overlooked so often. I think not a lot of people listening to classical music, especially people that are not familiar with string music, are going to be familiar with Lalo. So I think that he's one that gets overlooked a lot by non-string players.
Right. I would say that Lalo would actually be one of my favorite composers of many nationalities. But unfortunately, he stacked up against all these French greats, Franck, Bizet, Ravel, Debussy. So his music really does get overlooked in the grand sense of French music, and particularly in French Romanticism. But he has really just quite artistic works for the orchestra, Symphony Espagnole, his cello concerto and his violin concerto, the piano concerto, and his symphony are all really fantastic works that need to be programmed more often.
Yeah, there are also a lot of these works, though, are very demanding for the string section, particularly some of these concertos. It's really demanding solo playing for the soloist in a lot of these works.
Right, absolutely. And you're going to hear that in our listening of Lalo's cello concerto in D minor. This is the third movement from that work. I think you guys are going to really enjoy this one, but you're probably going to hear how demanding this one is. So let's go ahead and take a listen.
Thank you. that was the challenging cello concerto in D minor by Edward Lalo. Really, really demanding work and a really fun one to listen to because it really shows off the capabilities of the cello as an instrument. And it's accompanied so well with the orchestra in this case. It's really a fun work and it really shows Lalo's style a lot. You'll hear a lot of those kind of orchestral hits in the accompaniment part. And I think that's very typical for Lalo's compositions.
Right. Oh, I totally agree. And that way, I think it sounds a little bit like Tchaikovsky a little bit. But the, wow, just the sheer demand of this work. This excerpt, it's purposely deceiving because it starts off and it's like, oh, this isn't too bad. I mean, it's soft, it's exposed, but it's not going anywhere. But then once you get to the technique in there, oh my gosh, it gets crazy. Not just for the cellos, but for the orchestra. So a lot of great demand. Maybe that's a reason why it's not programmed as often, but I think that it's worth it.
So let's get into some composer facts for Edward Lalo. He might sound decidedly Spanish. However, Lalo is in fact French, and his family had been in France since the 16th century. His father even fought for Napoleon.
Yeah, so his family is pretty established in France, but they kept the Lalo name. Lalo studied violin and cello at the Lille Conservatoire. Due to his father's militaristic background, he was actually strongly discouraged from entering the profession of music. He left home at age 16 in defiance to go study in the Paris Conservatory, and then he's just... At this point, he's fuming. He's like, you know what? I'm going to write the most difficult string parts I can. But Lalo was a really key figure in the revival of interest in chamber music in France. He was the founder of the Armingot Quintet, which aimed at popularizing the string quartets of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven, Mendelssohn and Schumann. He played viola and second violin, so he played just about every string instrument there was, and he also is a big reason why we still hear the music of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven in terms of their string music, so I think that's huge.
It is, and again, that's why he is so great at writing string parts, because he was, first of all, studying the greats, and then also playing all of the different instruments that he would be writing for.
Right. He had such an intimate understanding of what the instruments could do and what Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn and all of them were doing in terms of that. So he made actually a lot of early attempts at composing, including two early symphonies that he wrote that he destroyed because he didn't like them. And then at age 43 in 1866, he finally begins to invest more in his composition career. So that's perhaps another reason why we don't hear about as much of Lalo as the composer. Lalo, like many composers of the time, was accused of imitating Wagner. Wagner was very, very popular. However, as time has moved on, connoisseurs have kind of agreed that Lalo actually had a really unique voice with a lot of really dynamic works like the one you heard today, as well as his Symphony Espanol and his Violin Concerto. And then there's an opera you wanted to talk about, Fernando.
Yeah, the composition that I did my project on for Lalo was actually Le Roi d'Ys, and it is an opera. It's a really great opera, and it really follows a little bit in the footsteps of Wagner in a way because of its musical style, but it also contributed to the French Grand Opera and that whole scene where they're just really going over the top with some of the music and some of the effects and all of the other things that were happening on the stage. It's one of his most well-known works, so I just wanted to include that one and keep in mind that he was contributing to the French Grand Opera scene.
Right, yeah, there's a lot going on with Lalo's music, from opera to orchestra to just string music in general. So lots of great stuff with Lalo here. Well, Fernando, what do you say we go ahead and move on to composer number 59 on today's list?
Yeah, let's go ahead and go on to 59.
All right. Alban Berg ranked number 59 on the combined list and 77 on mine, 58 on Fernando's. Interesting how almost exactly Berg and Webern are kind of swapped on our list. He's a Berg is another 20th century Austrian composer of the Second Viennese School. 1885 to 1935. Fernando, what do you like so much about Berg?
So like we said, Berg is actually my favorite strictly serialist composer from that Second Viennese School. He found ways to make serialism engaging and is able to hold my interest a little bit more than Webern or Schoenberg. But Berg does have a limited output, so he did fall a little bit on my list to 58. But overall, I like that he brings a little bit more drama to serialism and it isn't just strictly adhering to the rules to a point where it becomes more academic than really engaging.
Right. Yeah, I'm totally with you there. We don't have any listening today for Berg, unfortunately, a little bit too new, but definitely a lot of great music that we'll mention here later on. Let's talk a little bit more about some facts with Alban Berg. He's another member of the Second Viennese School, like we mentioned, along with Schoenberg, maybe a little bit more known for dabbling in different styles other than serialism, atonal music, some romantic styles, and some other modernist styles. But he doesn't really have as much output as the majority of composers on this list, and even compared to Webern and Schoenberg. Some of his best-known compositions are his operas Wozzeck and Lulu, Lulu being my favorite. Berg actually had this somewhat weird and complicated relationship with Arnold Schoenberg, his teacher, who's known for being kind of the ringleader of the Second Viennese School. Berg actually came to view Schoenberg as kind of a father figure and felt that he owed him an immense debt for Schoenberg's teachings. Schoenberg, weirdly though, expected his students to carry out all these various tasks for him, including organizing his musical life and his financial affairs. Letters back and forth kind of show that Berg was constantly seeking approval from Schoenberg. He'd write these really long-winded letters praising Schoenberg's music, but this ended up actually causing a bit of a precarious relationship between the two, because Berg, being so dedicated to pleasing his teacher Schoenberg, he never really felt the love on the other side of the token. Schoenberg was not too encouraging of a mentor figure, and also would have them do so much. Interesting thing there, the relationship kind of remedied a little bit when Berg came to a little bit more international success with works like Wozzeck that we mentioned before, one of his operas, and Berg ended up dedicating four of his works over the course of his composition catalog to his teacher Schoenberg, but Schoenberg did not return the favor. So a little bit of historical drama there that you might not know about Alban Berg here, but I found that story to be quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting story, a little bit humorous there. It's interesting to see the relationships between a lot of different composers, but to go back to Berg, I think if you're interested in getting into Berg and you want a little bit more of a dramatic twist on serialism, then Berg is the right person for you, and you want to start with his operas Wozzeck and Lulu. Both of those have a really, really interesting story, and they're very different than a lot of operas. They have a different climactic point than a lot of operas. It, especially Lulu in particular, actually kind of reaches its climactic point in the middle, and then descends into kind of another depressive point for the story and the main character. It's a really interesting one. It features also a palindrome of sorts, a musical palindrome where it's kind of being played back and forth in a way, kind of in reverse. So that's really cool. Like I said, it has a lot of interesting devices that make serialism just a little bit more interesting.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree there. And these are two works that I have still been familiarizing myself with. I've been a fan of Lulu for a while, but Wozzeck I haven't really been as much of a fan of, because I haven't really listened to a whole lot of it. But maybe that'll change my opinion. Maybe that'll make me flip-flop these two on my list.
These are pretty common works in academia. A lot of people will bring this up in music history classes of 20th century music.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very common. So now we're going to go completely in the opposite direction with our final composer on today's list, number 60, Johann Strauss II. I don't think you can get more different than Berg or Webern or Husa than this last composer. Number 37 on my list, 99 on Fernando. So not quite last on the list, Fernando, but close to it. Fernando, what do you think of Johann Strauss?
Well, Johann Strauss II was a master of waltzes. But almost to the point of redundancy. It becomes a little bit dry after a while, a bit stale, because it's just the waltz over and over again. Very tuneful and catchy melodies, but a lot of them start to sound similar because he just had a massive output of waltzes, and he kind of needed to, being in Vienna, where the waltz is so famous.
Right, yeah, I'm totally with you there. I think that this is a composer that has a little bit of freshness in my mind, having one of these previous summers, actually, I performed some Strauss II waltzes in Austria, and doing so and being under an Austrian conductor and having that interpretation really drew me in, and it's a really special memory for me. But Johann Strauss II being an Austrian romantic composer, quite frankly, is enough for me and kind of scratches that Austrian romantic itch for me. But let's talk about the works, because Blue Danube and Die Fledermaus are two of my favorite works by him. Blue Danube is one of his most famous waltz, and then Die Fledermaus is one of his most famous operas. And he's really not as well known for his operas, but Die Fledermaus is one that's really quite well known in the operatic literature. And speaking of listening, we've got a great selection for you today. This is the Blue Danube Waltz. You might not recognize the title, but you've definitely heard this at some point in your life. One of our favorite works by him. What do you say we take a listen to the Blue Danube Waltz?
All right, let's do it. Let's take a listen. That was Johann Strauss II's Blue Danube Waltz. Very, very popular one. Very well known. Equally delightful every time. It's light music, intended to be enjoyed and danced to. So definitely a dance-like quality, and it's very tuneful, melodious. All of the really great waltzes by Johann Strauss II are very, very tuneful, and this one is one that I will probably whistle for the rest of the day.
Yeah, it's really quite fantastic. I'm really just such a huge fan of his great waltzes like this, as well as some of his other nearly 500 waltzes and polkas and other dance music, and many of them were lost to history. So that's it's great that we had a lot of these works that have survived, and you have a waltz for every situation when it comes to Johann Strauss II. So love it. It is great. So let's talk a little bit more about where that second part, or the junior on Johann Strauss II, actually came from. He was a composer and conductor and violinist in Vienna. Originally, Strauss II was set up for a career in banking, but he chose music even after receiving first with distinction in his bookkeeping examination. So history could have gone very different for a young Johann Strauss II, but we're glad that he chose to stick with music. Like we said earlier, he's known for nearly 500 waltzes and polkas and other dance music. He didn't see as much success until after his father's death, Johann Strauss Sr., the first. He was also a prolific composer and a tenant of what would become this this famous musical dynasty of Johann Strauss, Johann Strauss II, Johann's brother, Joseph Strauss. With his brother, they actually held really like a stranglehold on the dance music scene in Vienna, and that's obviously where most of his composition and income came from. So it only makes sense that he's most well known for that.
Right, gotta do what makes you money.
Yes, absolutely. What a great composer. I think that this has been one of my personal favorite episodes in terms of listening that we've done. There's maybe not all these composers are close to our favorites. However, I think that we got to play a lot of their best work today for a lot of these composers. I think for Johann in particular, as well as Wagner and Dukas, Borodin, all these composers that we presented you today, I think we've gotten to present you with some of their most iconic works. So I've been really happy with that.
Yeah, a lot of really great listening, diverse listening. And even for the ones that we didn't get to listen to on the show, be sure to check them out if you'd like, because they are equally interesting composers and their music just adds to the diversity of this list.
Right. Totally agree. Well, with that, I think that we might be getting close to wrapping up today, Fernando.
Yeah, I think we're just about done. So obviously, if you liked any music that you heard today or that you heard about today, be sure to check that out. Be sure to check out our social media platforms that are listed in the outro. Other than that, have a great day, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at the Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and the Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of the Leading Tone Podcast.